Weather's looking pretty good today, but it's not. I got out for a little while this morning because after about an hour or two, the temperature's gonna be dropping from the 50 it is now to probably down into the 30s and a little rain this evening, and go from there.
Yeah, the cold weather's headed this way too. You usually get it first because, of course, it comes from the north, and
yeah.
Then Mom will get it in St. Louis, and Mom and Jeff, and then
right.
We'll get it. Mary Jane and I'll get it down here. So yeah.
So.
It's all good.
Yeah, busy 24 hours in Chicago. 6 people shot and killed.
Whoa. This Chicago thing has become a thing.
Well, I mean, as I've pointed out before, a nice day in the. And our weather was really good yesterday, and that brings a lot of people out. And I have my own theory. I'm sure the police would dispute it, that good weather brings on more violence.
Whoa. Well, I don't think there's much doubt about that. I would like to hear how they contest that.
Well, I mean, it's just they think there's obviously a lot of other factors, and weather might be just a...
Yeah, well, it doesn't make
part,
them
part
do
of the puzzle.
It.
No.
No, it doesn't. No, it
but
doesn't
it
make
sets
people
up a nice environment for it, though.
Yes, of course. It doesn't encourage it necessarily, yeah. But the cold weather discourages it.
Yep, that's for sure.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah. Speaking of the news, you know, I was really struck. I got to thinking about this thing with this bathroom order. I don't think it's a law, is it? It's an order, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an order.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's two things about this that I don't think people are thinking about or talking about enough. These transgendered kids, and adults for that matter, have a really high suicide rate already.
Oh.
So this isn't going to help. I mean, I think they're at like 46%. That's high.
So that is pretty high.
Yeah, real high. So... You know, that's one thing. And then the other thing that struck me was, let's kind of follow what the process is for a male to female transgender kid. When they're pubescent, yeah, that's the word, they don't have to do anything with their hormones. And they don't have these urges or whatever that would make them dangerous in a bathroom.
Yeah.
And the ones that are entering puberty get androgen blockers, strong ones. So you and I know a little about this because part of prostate cancer treatment is androgen blockers.
Yep.
And anyone will tell you who's had that shot or taken those pills, you're
not
pretty
much
damn
life.
Harmless.
Yeah, you're not much life down there.
No, the thing is that everybody's focusing, in fact, I just saw a tweet about this, you know, oh, why are they doing this? And this guy tweets, well, boys have penises and girls have vaginas. Well, guess what? Once they take those blockers, those penises aren't used for anything except peeing, just to put it bluntly. Mm-hmm. And even not just that. But, you know, I was talking to Jeff the other day, and he said, God, you know, I had that shot, because, of course, our brother Jeff has had prostate cancer, too. He said, I had that shot, and if I were to look at, you know, like a scantily clad woman or something in a picture or an ad or anything like that, he said, I noticed nothing. There's nothing there. He said, I don't have any of the reactions I had before the shot. And I thought to myself this morning, seeing these things, wait a minute, guys. Number one, you're pushing the suicide rate higher, I think. I don't see any way it's going to get lower. This is not going to help them.
Nope.
And then factor number two, I don't think you have all the data here. I don't think you know what's really happening. So, stupid and... Stupid. I don't get it. You know, I know that it's turned into a political thing, I guess, now, but this is about people. And now, okay, now they did add this writer to the whole thing saying, hey, this is not to say we ease up on bullying. But you know what? What are you going to do? Have monitors in the bathroom? In a stall?
Yeah.
I mean, wow.
Yeah, it is pretty sad. Another screw up by Trump. What can I say?
Well, I think it is. You know, I think it is. And, you know, it's gotten to the point now where, you know, I'm starting to feel sorry for the guy. You know, I was never really mad at him. You know, I've disagreed with a lot of the presidents we've had. But I always try to see the good stuff in other people. I want to be friends with people and want to act in a friendly manner toward people and think friendly thoughts about people. And I can see the humanity in the guy. He's not a monster, but the way he's going about these things is just simply not working for so many people. You know, his approval rating now is 38, and his disapproval rating is 55, I think, or higher maybe, which is, these are both records, of course, for the first month of an office. And, you know, one of the polls, and it's a conservative poll, those are numbers from them, and the guy who did the poll even commented, you know, and he broke it down on what the things are that are causing those disapproval and approval ratings. So, and even he is not saying good things. So this is not good for us. And he is our president, whether you voted for him or not.
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs, no doubt.
One other thought occurs to me too. There's all these now. There's the town hall stuff and the protests and all that going on. The thing is that, and Mitch McConnell goes, well, hey, you know, the way it works is when one party wins the election, that means the other party loses, and so it's the winners who get to, you know, essentially rule or, you know, make law and all that stuff, and you guys don't. And so that was his justification for, hey, you know, all these people who want to protest, they're the losers and they don't get to. And wow, that is so far off. If you, let's say you have a representative there in Illinois, in your district or whatever, and you didn't vote for him, he's still your representative and he still has to listen to what you got to say.
True.
Right?
No doubt.
Well, yeah, and, Mitch McConnell just really put his foot in it, I think. Anyways, enough of that. I don't want to talk about politics the whole time.
Well, I think with Trump, the thing I notice is I wonder when the victory celebration stops. I mean, it seems like every time you see him, he's on a, you know, a victory celebration is with his, and maybe it'll stop now that he's been so inaccurate in terms of the numbers, and it's been pointed out to him. Hopefully, that'll end that, that display. Because he gets so much pleasure out of his victory that I don't think he's gotten beyond that.
Well, yeah, it's like a bender. He's on a bender. You know, it's like a dry drunk.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, again, one more embarrassing thing, but yeah. Yeah. Again, that's part of what makes me feel sorry for him, too. I'm going, oh, geez. You know, I've been to enough AA meetings. I know what that is. Yeah. Wow. Anyways. So, something more cheerful. To regale us with something good going on in sports, if you can.
Well, I mean, baseball season is, we got spring training, and spring training's pretty, it's optimistic because it doesn't mean anything. I mean, the results are not part of the regular season. If you win, it's okay. If you lose, well, we were playing rookies and looking at prospects, so we accomplished this, we accomplished that. So I don't think there's a more positive time. I mean, I think probably most clubs' objective in spring training is to come out of your spring training without injury. Quite often it's amazing to see how many clubs will look so good in spring training and look at the beginning, and all of a sudden by the end of it, they're decimated by a couple of key injuries. So again, it's just kind of holding your breath and hope that nobody lands in the hospital or on the DL. Is part of the key to the exercise. The games, the actual spring training games, start a little bit today and tomorrow and really rev up on Saturday. And so it'll just be nice to be able to listen to, you know, the familiar names and kind of trying to imagine what's going on in either Florida or Arizona as they start playing the games. So that's it's the upside right now, and
or at least it's a do no harm kind of thing.
Yeah, it's
exactly. It's not happy news necessarily, but at least it's not bad.
Yeah, some clubs get a little bit more excited, like the Cubs are right now. They always try to come up with a theme. Humility is their theme this year, one of the words they're using. Their manager, Joe Maddon, is real key on coming up with phrases or, last year one of their phrases was, just don't suck, you know.
Yeah.
Don't screw up. That's the idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, so, sure. The first time I heard that, that's interesting you bring that up. I think it was like in the 1980s, there's this company, Barebone Software, and they wrote an application for the Mac. It's called BB Edit, Barebone's Editor. So it's an editor that a lot of programmers use. And it's got over the years, it's accumulated a huge following and a huge number of little add-ons you can have that, you know, make coding easier. You know, it'll colorize your code so that you can tell a command from a function and all that kind of stuff. But the cool thing about it was that was their first T-shirt.
Really?
BB Edit, and then the tagline was, it doesn't suck.
Yeah.
Oh God.
So he,
good.
You know.
So he used that last year, the Cubs.
Yeah, just don't suck, and he sold a lot of T-shirts. Believe me. Well, with that line, and he's an interesting fella. He's whether you like the Cubs or not, he keeps the players engaged, but in a positive way, in a playful way. Although they're serious, but they realize it's a game. It's a game to be enjoyed, and the more you can enjoy it, probably the more productive you're going to be. So,
yeah,
you know, it's interesting being a manager. At this point, managers have probably 8 or 9 coaches. So as a result, when it comes to, they even got a bench coach who will then be the quality control on strategy. So when it comes to strategy, or overseeing, you know, doing this or doing that, so much is delegated that you're basically left with, you know, with managing people and how you manage your coaches and how you manage your players. And I think that it was interesting when Casey Sengel said one time, he says, you know, there's probably going to be in a team of 25, there's probably going to be 10 guys who don't like you, 10 players, and there's probably 10 players that are going to like you. The key to the exercise is to keep the 5 players that haven't made up their mind away from the ones who don't like you.
Jesus, Nagel, wow.
Yeah, that was his way.
That's coaches.
You wouldn't believe. In fact, there's a coach that keeps track of, like, in spring training, making sure that they have a certain routine of things that they do in terms of exercises and different drills, and a guy that basically works up the plan and makes sure that it happens. So it's kind of it's amazing how baseball is had, you know, used to be, there'd be, when I was a kid, you'd have a pitching coach, you'd have a third base coach and a first base coach, and maybe a bullpen coach. But now you've got at least twice that many. In fact, when it comes to hitting coaches,
wow.
Sometimes you'll have a left-handed hitting coach and you have a right-handed hitting coach.
Wow. Speaking of great coaches, now what was Yogi Berra's role when he was, he would go to spring training and all that kind of stuff?
Well, what they have is, the Yankees are ones that are very, very, do a lot of this, and that is they have these guest coaches. They have what they call spring training instructors. And Casey and Yogi Berra was, you know, and certain players would be invited down, and they would either, most of the time they weren't too involved in instruction. They were more in terms of inspirational, motivational, and, you know, talking and keeping, you know, with the various players and prospects, etc. In fact, you know, Bo Jackson is one of these types of, he's an instructor for the White Sox.
Wow, and I didn't know that.
Bo was so, as a baseball player, relied practically totally on his physical capability. He did not have what you call an approach when it comes to at the plate. He had a lot of confidence, and he would do the, you know, and he performed well, particularly in the clutch. So when he would go to spring training, he was instructed by the White Sox. The White Sox told him, said, "Bo, you can do whatever you want. Just don't instruct hitters how to hit, because you have no approach." So it was kind of funny, you know. But Bo's just for his personality. He's a great guy, great all around athlete.
Yeah. Well, and I want to bring something up here as we're talking about this. I've got a couple friends listening to the podcast from Australia, and they know nothing about American baseball.
You know, about baseball, there's an Australian Winter League right now, and there's probably maybe three or four Australians in the majors, but there's a bunch of them in the minor leagues. So I know that cricket, rugby, soccer,
footy,
are all more popular. In fact, when it comes to Australia, I think one of the more exciting sports that they can take pride in being their own is Australian rules football. It's a super exciting game, and when I was in Australia in 2000, I made a point of going to see a couple of their games. They try to take the best of several sports. There's obviously they can actually move the ball by running. They can move the ball by kicking it and then having somebody catch it. And then they score, through putting the ball through the goal, goalpost. And it's an exciting game that originated in Melbourne, but has since, probably in the last 20 years, has expanded, to the stretches of even out to Perth, on the other side. I saw a game in Melbourne, and I saw a game in Sydney, and it was a lot of fun. So. Yeah, they got great sports, and I mean, they're very enthusiastic. Melbourne is to me the kind of the sports capital of Australia, because they've got a lot of their tennis thing, their car racing, in addition to all these, all the regular sports. So, it's all good. Australians, I think, have a little more sense of baseball, and actually. Maybe one or two years ago, the Major League Baseball came to Sydney and played opening their season, and I think it was the Dodgers playing the D-backs at the Sydney Cricket Ground, which was kind of interesting, trying to conform that into a ballpark. And I found one of the more interesting things about going to having a game at Sydney Cricket Ground is that it might be the oldest venue in which a Major League Baseball game has been played, because the cricket ground actually the oval is really big, and they are constantly renovating portions of it in this circle. So, one year they might just tear down a stand and do a new one, but there's some of the portions of this cricket ground that have been around way beyond before 1900. So, I've never done the research on it, but. I think Major League Baseball has tried to make an effort to, at least in two ways, with the Australian Winter League, and also with introducing Major League ball with an opening day. The one thing about the Australian Winter League is that more teams are sending prospects over there, so it's just not a bunch of native Australians. Although there are a lot of native Australians playing in this league, there is also a good number of prospects that go over to Australia. And I think one of the things about playing ball there is that they don't play as often. They'll probably, rather than playing four or five times a week, they'll play three times a week. So if the players, they don't want them to kind of, they want them to kind of ease back maybe after an injury and not play a lot, it could provide the right atmosphere in which to sharpen your skills and progress as a player.
Yeah, and so, by native you mean born there or live there, as opposed to indigenous, which would be the Aborigines, etc.
Yeah. I mean the ones who live there.
Yeah.
Well, although I'll tell you right now, I have seen some. I have actually gone to a minor league game in which there were some Aborigines playing minor league ball. There was a set of twins that I saw. I forget. One guy, his nickname was Boss, and he was their better. The player was a Red Sox, Boston Red Sox. I saw this in Lowell, Massachusetts. So even the natives have to some extent, not much, but to some extent have kind of, you know, taken on baseball. So,
are there any Native American baseball stars?
Native American,
Thorpe, I guess Jim Thorpe at one point, right?
Oh. Indians, Allie, yeah. There's been, I would say probably, well, there are some Hall of Famers. There's one name, there was a pitcher by the name of Chief Bender, obviously, you know, he's Native American, and he was from that era back in the, there were a lot of Indians in the, like, between 1900 and 1920. And Chief Bender was a pitcher for the Philadelphia Athletics. He's a Hall of Famer, considered one of the clutch pitchers during the postseason. And so he's won. Thorpe played a little bit of ball for the Giants and a couple other teams, but actually his prowess was more in terms of football when it comes to professional sports. But one of the things that Chief, I've read several books about Indians and Native Americans and baseball, and one of the things that was happening was back then there was a big effort to try to Americanize, that's kind of the wrong term probably, Indians.
Yeah.
To make them more like, you know, just the people
mainstream.
That have come over, mainstream. Yeah. And that's what, you know, Carlisle University and O'Brien,
yeah,
and this happened
about.
To Chief, you know, these Indians were just basically, you know, taken off the reservation and thrown into schools to try to Americanize them. And,
well, that's been done. I mean, that's all the reservations have that. And the Indians they considered more of a threat, they did even more of it to them. There's generations of Lakota people who have all went to boarding school, were not allowed to speak their language, had to cut their hair, and it was pretty traumatic for a lot of them.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is that baseball is kind of fit in. The reason I know a fair amount about it is because a couple of really good baseball players were subjected to that and basically made their way through baseball and, were made it as a living and did well even afterwards. And they were, you know, it was a tough road. I mean, I'm not saying that was a success in terms of for them personally, but that's the way I found out about this. I know it was a real big ordeal and tough on Native Americans.
Yeah, it's pretty awful in a lot of ways if you think about it. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I don't know who I heard talk about this, but this is a topic, you know, I think you'd have something to say about too, is that when we had the draft, there was a lot of people did military service, and so you know when it was eliminated, that just wasn't there. So you know the upside of a draft is that you get a bunch of people, and they get to experience the world. They get outside of their hometown, they get overseas, they see other cultures, they do all this kind of stuff. And of course, the Peace Corps would do that too. That was the upside of that. But there's so little of that kind of thing going on anymore that, you know, there's large numbers of people who don't get that experience. And so I was just thinking about the same thing, you know. What happens is these kids go to these boarding schools. And in the case of professional sports, you know, they really get a bird's eye view of what's going on in the rest of the United States anyway. And in some cases, you know, get to travel overseas and see the world, and that can be very. I think that's the upside of some of these things. And,
well, I can tell you that just you know, being in the service for almost 3 years myself, and being drafted, that when you say, you know, give it, you have a chance to experience the world. Before you experience the world, you have a chance to experience America and a wide variety of people. And yeah. I always felt that that although, you know, it didn't exactly hit my career path going into the service, there were definitely some positives that came out of it that that probably would bode well for me just as much as taking a complicated accounting course. And I think the main thing I learned was that you have an interaction with a variety of different people, whether it be from different parts of the U.S., from different economic status, all kinds of things. I don't know why, but when I was in Fort Lee, Virginia, you know, you always kind of congregate with, you know, have certain guys you kind of hang with. And I would hang with, one of them was black and the other one was an Indian.
Right.
And we were the three musketeers. And, you know, one of them was from California. I forget where the other one was. But we just seemed to kind of hit it off together. And we just always do things together. And I was kind of interesting. I was kind of thinking back if whether we ran into any problems in terms of, you know, we would go around Virginia. But it didn't seem to be a problem at the time, or at least I didn't notice it. In terms of segregation or bias of sorts that still lingered on in some of those southern states,
but well, the uniform helps.
Yeah, you're right. The uniform helps, and that goes a long way. So, yeah, and then in addition to getting overseas, and I was in Vietnam only, so I really didn't have a lot of exposure there, but some. But
you
I
got
was
to go
more
to Bangkok and stuff like that. That's good.
Yeah, that was that was interesting too. R&R, but I always felt that the most important thing for me was learning about the people of the United States was probably the key thing. And there were in learning how to work with people, and because I know that when I came back and continued my schoolwork, that I did much better afterwards than I did in some courses that I would have never done as well before.
Wow.
So, you're confronted with a situation that maybe isn't what optimal for you. But what you got to do is you got to find the best pieces of it. And I was able to find a fair amount in the service, learning a variety of skills, learning how to do a multitasking, having three or four jobs and trying to, you know, bounce around and do this and do that. So, you know, I can look back on it, and even though I was in a situation where there was some danger, and there was always a chance that things, either through accidents or otherwise, you could get yourself, you know, hurt, be a casualty. Looking back, and since I really didn't have a lot of that happen to me, I felt that overall it was a positive experience, me being in the service. I always felt that way about it. I didn't feel like it was a loss through 3 years.
Right. Good. Yeah, I know. You've always said that, and I think, that two interesting points about that, a couple of interesting points about that anyway. One is, I've spent quite a bit of time on American Indian reservations up in the Dakotas and what have you, and when I go to an event, particularly like a powwow, I am continually struck by the high percentage of men and women who from the reservation go into the service, and they have, and this has been going on for a long time.
Right.
I mean, this is just recent. Every war, not just wartime, but all the time. And of course, part of it is economic. It's a chance for them to get out, you know, because they have 80% unemployment
right.
on the Pine Ridge Reservation,
right.
for instance. But it's much more than that. It comes from the heart. And when they have a powwow, a big part of it is every day they put up the American flag next to their tribal flag, and their guy, and it's very formal. And you know, they really are into it. They that's a big part of their culture. And so. Yeah, that's always kind of been a point of interest to me anyway, is that, you know, there's this weird thing. And then I heard some of the people I talked to, one of the guys said, I said, well, you know, hey, given, you know, the relationship with the U.S. government over the years and, you know, your tribe, what's the deal, you know? And he said, you guys don't get it. this is our country.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Crunch, like, you. Yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. It was pretty interesting.
But I mean, I think you're right about the you know, quite often, certain, you know, people that are having difficulty, you know, with employment, whether whatever segment of the population that happens to be, the service does provide an opportunity to you know, to not only serve your country and feel good and make some money, but it also provides you with an opportunity to learn a skill, because particularly if you sign up with the service, they'll guarantee you for, like, if you sign up for 3 or 6 years, they will guarantee you that you will be able to learn, and you can pick out some things that you want to do and get the training and the schoolwork to come out of it. If you decide after 6 years, hey, this isn't for me, at least you have something you can, you put on your resume, some skill that you can market to the workforce. So
that's huge. That's huge. My old boss, my old CEO, I worked for a regional tech company, a consulting firm, and it was pretty good sized company. And he moved over to Cisco for a long time, and then he's you know, he's like us, he's around retirement age. So he's now running a group that does nothing but get veterans into tech jobs. That's his whole thing.
Ah.
He takes, yeah, that, and he's a really good guy. So, yeah, yeah. In fact, I was just thinking yesterday, I said I should probably hook John up with him, because he takes guys who, you know, retired guys in particular, to help mentor some of these guys and work them through it. I thought you'd be perfect for that. He's a good guy too. Jim Scharf's a really nice guy.
Well, you know, that's part of the challenge of our, you know, of our economy, is the fact that it's, you know, the change we have in the workforce, the skills needed, et cetera, is so, it changes even more rapid every year. So that means that you're constantly having to retool your workforce to be able to satisfy the needs for productivity.
Oh yeah.
And so there's got to be a constant, you know, educational element that allows this to be, you know, done in a smooth way. It's one of the challenges of, you know, basically technology, is that you put yourself in a position where you have a new technology, but you don't have the people that can basically do it.
Oh,
you
got to
basically, you got to educate that workforce, and that can be a challenge.
Oh yeah, and you know, the thing is that that's what's so wrong-minded about this Make America Great thing. You're not going to do it by opening more coal mines and bringing back old jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And even if you
It takes the rust off the rust belt, huh?
Yeah, but I mean, just think about it for a second. You know, let's say we bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. Hey, bravo. Guess what? They're going to use robots. There's just no way they're not. Now, yeah. Bill Gates has recently suggested we should tax robots, which is an interesting idea. But that's not the answer either. I mean, the thing is that, yeah, there are going to be fewer jobs. So we kind of have to redefine what work is. And people are definitely going to have to continually upgrade their skills, because you can just not compete with this much change. And believe me, the amount of automation that could be used is much more than is being used, mostly because of this training thing, but also just because there are a lot of regulations around the world that keep automation out, like in France particularly.
Oh, really?
To preserve jobs, feather bedding, if you will, we used to call it, right? And that's the rate of change could be much faster, and I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying it's being held back now, luckily, so people can kind of catch up. But that's the challenge, and you know, we're going to have to look at income distribution and all kinds of things very, very differently. And the thing I've seen recently that's been the most promising is guaranteed incomes, you know, UBI or whatever you want to call it, universal basic income. Those things have been extremely successful anywhere in the world. They've done large, well-structured and tested pilots. They've got a huge percentage of success rates, and people do not sit on their laurels and just collect money. Even people who had done that with welfare don't do it with UBI. So criminals, it's a huge success for criminals. These are like, they did a research project in, it was Oroville or someplace like that, I'm thinking Oroville because of that damn thing, but it's
that damn
Bay.
Thing.
Yeah, it's one of those towns up there on BART, yeah. You know, when you go over the across the bay. I can't remember what it is, uh-huh. Though. But they did a huge study there where this guy went in and said, okay, he went to the parole guys and said, okay, I want your worst guys. I want the guys who are violence with handgun kind of offenders, and people who are just fixing to really mess up. Let's get those numbers. Give me the names and whatever. Let's offer them a program. I've got the funding, and we're going to give them $1,000 a month, universal basic income. And let's see what happens. And this thing morphed into something really interesting, because what happened was, like, they had a 96% success rate, and one of the things that made it work was the new guys coming into the program were mentored by the guys already in the program, and the guys in the program would go, look, this is a really good thing. Here's how we've worked it. And it was a total success because of it, because it created a community, and it created a culture, a different one.
That kind of brings us back to what I started with, and that is the six deaths in Chicago over the last 24 hours, and the solution lies in basically providing those people with economic opportunity, giving them some hope, and that's, you know, you can only do so much with respect to law enforcement. It's got to start with improving. I mean, these communities were the west side and south side of Chicago, the unemployment rates are astronomical. So as a result, providing these people with programs is, like you just mentioned, is the basis upon which these problems can be addressed.
Oh, yeah. People don't understand. If you're not in the situation, you don't understand it. And that's what the big diff is. And, you know, this pertains to what we were talking about a couple of days ago with you know, cancer treatments, is you have a whole health industry that if for some reason, even though some of these health professionals have been through the process themselves, once they're acting like a health professional, suddenly it's not just that they might lack empathy, it's not anything as soft as that, it's just that they don't really understand what's happening. Like, you know, let's say you've got a treatment and you're in pain, and the guy tells you, like I told you the other day, you know, hey, you know, this is going to be over in 3 months. You've already got, you know, 1 month down. You're in great shape, you know, but you're not in great shape. You're in pain. And, you know, pain gets like a television. You can't see the future, and you can't see the past.
I the thing is, I was listening to somebody this morning, Dale Earnhardt, who's a race car driver, apparently was in a bad accident, and he's really has a lot of recuperation. He's probably not even going to race car drive again. But he commented that what he needed to do was it was negative for people to constantly ask him how he was.
Yeah.
Because it offered him just another way of, you know, whining and complaining when he needed to concentrate on what he is. And what, you know, where he stands, and you know, concentrate on himself, not trying to explain somebody, you know, what's going on. I mean, there's a lot that can be said for being talking to people and working through things, but sometimes you just need to step back and take a look and assess things inwardly a little bit more rather than outwardly.
True.
So it's kind of a mixed bag of tricks, no doubt.
Yeah, it is, and there's a balance, a different balance for every person and how they handle all that
stuff.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And in myself, like I told you, I think we were talking a couple of weeks ago, I said, you know, I just have to give myself a little pep talk every morning, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, every day is not going to be, every day, you don't want to measure your progress based upon what happens in one day. Because yes. one day might not be that good, and the next day might be better. And it might even take a week or longer before you actually... So, because there's going to be bumps in the road, there's going to be a variety of things going on that you got to take a look at the big picture as to where you want to be at a certain point in time, rather than trying to assess things too in much detail. You got to take a much look at the bigger picture, and I mean, that's all part of it. It is amazing. I mean, you can. Like yesterday wasn't my best day, but today I wake up, I did a little more reading, did this and did that. And I'm feeling a lot more positive. And just listening to Dale Earnhardt this morning made me feel good. So, it's a day-by-day thing, and you just got to keep an even keel.
Yeah, it's important. Not always easy. The deal killer here is pain, you know, and that's why I think these oncologists hand out, I mean, they are the experts at painkillers. I mean, these guys hand this stuff out like candy, like we were talking about. And now I'm starting to understand a little bit why. Because too much of that continual, even if it's low-grade pain, that starts to really mess with you. And you do start losing the big picture quickly. And it gets a smaller and smaller and smaller. And so... and that's where
my oncologist yesterday, I mean, said that in so many words. The fact is, we want you to get some control over your pain before it overwhelms you.
Perfect.
You know what I mean? Before it becomes too much. And they don't mean so too much in terms of the level of pain. They mean now that you've said it that way, it has to do with messing with your mind and what you're doing and how you feel and what you know, because it's amazing how you're at it and with your attitude. Is what it boils down to with your attitude.
Yeah. Well, I see the sense of it. I know where they're coming from, and I was always amazed by how quickly, you know, these guys respond to anything. If you use the P word, if you say pain or discomfort and stuff like that, they you get their attention because this is their trigger, and you can, it's easy to become cynical about it, and we have become cynical about it and joked about it. These guys, you know, how I had a procedure that, you know, didn't require that much pain medication, but here I'm sitting here with, you know, a bottle, a 60-count bottle of hydrocodone that has a pretty good street value, and I'm going, whoa, what's that for? But now I'm starting to understand what that's for, because not every day is the same, and I have had a dip into that from time to time, and luckily I thought it through. And thought to myself, well, you know, let's take sleep, for instance. You're not getting any sleep. And we all know what that does over a period of time. You're gonna start, you know, losing the big picture and getting small-minded and not just irritated. Right. It's not just about discomfort. You know, sometimes it's about self-preservation. I mean, this stuff can get bad and people hang themselves and shit. So, that's where they're coming from on this, and I'm starting to appreciate it more because I've had a couple of really bad days too. And you know, sometimes at night I'm just going, wow, I haven't had a good night's sleep in forever. It's because my catheter is causing me discomfort. I think I can get ahead of this if I can sleep. So bam, hello, Mr. Hydrocodone. right? Bam. It's done. Don't have to think about it. And the next day, fine. You know, the other thing interesting about painkillers, they did a huge study on morphine. And people who are in these situations where they're sitting in a hospital on those beds and they've got the little button where they hit the button for more morphine, self-administered, the thought is, oh my God, they're going to make all these addicts when they get out of there. That's not what happens, evidently. If you are in pain and you use that stuff, it is not addicting. So if you're using it as a medicine and not for recreation, it works, number one. And number two, the percentages in several studies show no, you're not destined to become an opiate addict or anything like that.
It's sort of like if you're in the hospital and the nurse says, now it's time for your pill. You know what? Maybe it isn't time for my pill. Maybe I should indicate when I have the pain and I should be taking it rather than taking it at a certain point in time.
True. Well, depending upon what you've just undergone. Coming out of anesthesia.
Oh yeah, I understand. It's
yeah, of course. Yeah, but you're talking like day after.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain things you have to take. You don't have any choice.
Well, we hit 45 minutes. Father.
Yeah, I think we've covered a lot, and
yeah.
A lot of good stuff, no doubt.
As my family in Holland would say, goed zo, good job.
Okay.
All right, buddy.
Sounds good. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.